Today's show is brought to you by Audible. Visit audiblepodcast.com/auctionpodcast for your free audiobook download.
Hi, everyone. This is Martin Willis in the Antique Auction Podcast, and I'm on the East Coast, and Phyllis is not, so I've got several podcasts that I'm doing back here. And we are in a nice early colonial town, Exeter, New Hampshire, today in a studio. And one of the things I've talked about in the past, the connection that people have with antiques, is it kind of solidifies our past, and I don't think there's any other place like images that solidify it more. And I'm here with a daguerreotype collector, dealer, Dennis Waters. How you doing, Dennis?
Doing great today, Marty.
Good, good. I had heard one time or read someplace a nice quote that I liked, that a picture makes a prisoner of the present moment. Are you familiar with that?
You know, I've never heard of that. And I'd sort of say that, you know, I don't think prisoner is the right term, because most of these people, although some of them look pretty grim, most of these people, you know, went into a daguerreotypist and they wanted to have a remembrance made. And since each image is unique, because they could only make one at a time, I think people would not really think they were captured on the plate. Mm. I think maybe that it's more like they were revealed on the plate.
Now, yeah, but, you know, I went to take a photograph one time in Taos, New Mexico, and the Native Americans certainly don't like being captured on.
Been there, seen that, yeah. Done it myself. Use a long lens next time.
Okay, I'll keep that in mind. So daguerreotypes, let's talk about daguerreotypes just to keep our listeners educated on who was the first person to develop it and what is the process.
Well, Louis Jacques Monde Daguerre, a Frenchman, worked in concert with Joseph Niépce, who in the mid-1820s managed to put an image on a plate.
Really?
Daguerre, Niépce died, I think, right around 1830. Daguerre continued to experiment, and what Daguerre did, he took copper plates that were clad with finely rolled silver, and he used iodine to excite the silver molecules and make them light sensitive. Hmm. So what he did, first he had to polish the silver to a mirror-like surface. Then he used iodine to excite the chemistry. He would put the finished plate in a wooden plate holder that had a dark slide, so it would be completely dark when he took it out of the coating room.
A dark slide means it was covered?
Yes, a piece of wood that you could pull up and down within the wooden slide itself.
I see. Uh-huh.
So then he had a camera that was a box within a box, and the inner box could move front to back, and that would help him focus through a lens that had no shutter. It was just two glass elements, and he would use a mirror to focus the spot where the sensitized plate would go. So then he would put the sensitized plate in the darks in the plate holder in the camera after he took out the mirror.
I see. So he saw it with the mirror, the focus first.
That's correct.
And then he exchanged it with the...
in the same plane.
Ah, wow.
So once he had his shot set up, and he only took exteriors or still lifes for the most part, because the exposure time when he was experimenting in the early 1830s could have been as much as 2 hours long. Mm. He had to devise the exposure table, because if the light was bright sunlight, it was shorter. If it was an overcast, it was longer. If it was a really gray day, it would be much longer. Mm-hmm. So obviously the process as he developed it would not allow people to sit for an hour or two to be taken. When the process came to America in the fall of 1839, the Americans took to it immediately. And in Philadelphia, Robert Cornelius and Dr. Paul Beck Goddard worked at the end of 1839 and into the beginning of 1840. And Goddard experimented and suggested to Cornelius that they should coat the plate with iodine and bromine, and that lessened the exposure time from, I think Daguerre's best exposure time was probably 15 minutes. It brought their exposure time down to 10 minutes, and then by adding more elements in the lens, it brought it down to 5 minutes, and probably by about 1842, a good daguerreotypist could make an exposure in 10 seconds in bright, bright sunlight.
Wow. Now, I had read somewhere, I don't know, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, that they found the earliest American daguerreotype, and it was from a church steeple. Are you familiar with that?
Well, that's one down in Boston at the Mass Historical Society, I think, mm-hmm. that you're referring to.
Yeah.
And it's still some conjecture about who made it and how early it is.
Mm-hmm.
I have held in my hands daguerreotypes made in Newburyport, Mass. In the fall of 1839
wow.
by a man named Henry Coit Perkins. He had been experimenting in this country, independent of Daguerre, since the middle of the 1830s. And there's so much conjecture about those who care about his daguerreotypes, which I can count on one hand, because very early dags are not, they're not really looked upon with great favor because they're very thin, they're very cold-toned, and most of the time the people had moved, and the focus with the lenses just weren't very good. It so happens I've made my specialty, you know, studying very early American portraits, 1839 through 1842, into the beginning of 1843. Mm-hmm. And in fact, on my website, I have an article, How to Date Very Early Daguerreotypes, which some of your listeners might find interesting.
Yes, your website is going to be linked. We're going to be talking later on your about your salon page that you have on your website. So if you're listening through my website, not iTunes, if you click on the link below, you will see Dennis's website, and we'll be talking about those images later on. A lot of times I've seen, now I know a little bit about these things, but not, you know, anywhere near as much as you. I know that things like architecture, things other than portraits are much rarer than portraits themselves. Is that right?
It is. When I first started collecting in 1985, you could buy baskets full of portraits in antique shops and at shows for $25 or less, or you had to pay $1,000 or more for ones that were large plates.
Right.
Now, a whole plate dag, the standard sizes were whole plate, which was 6.5 by 8.5 inches. And in theory, if you took a sixth plate dag, 2¾ by 3¼ inches, you could get six plate dags from a whole plate. And you could get 4 quarter plates and 2 half plates.
Okay,
if you trimmed very, very carefully.
Okay, so let me just get this straight. The plates, I've always heard this half plate, quarter plate, eighth plate, all that. Now, they're obviously cut ahead of time.
Yep.
And it's all the process of the silver that you mentioned, silver clad copper. If you look at a daguerreotype, you can tell a daguerreotype from an ambrotype or something like that because of the silvery look, almost a mirror-like look.
Correct. The daguerreotype plate, again, is copper with the clad silver. The silver is highly polished to a mirror-like surface. The actual image is in the silver itself. So that when daguerreotypists first started to present their images, they used either a paper or a brass mat, and then they put a piece of glass, just regular windowpane glass, over the image, and they made a seal using a gut or using some kind of paper and glue so that you had a package that was protected from the elements, so to speak.
I see.
And then they put them in leather cases that had been previously used for miniatures painted on ivory.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. And by about 1842, it was a cottage industry. One place would produce cases. In fact, you've probably heard of Matthew Brady, the great Civil War photographer.
Went bankrupt after the Civil War.
He did.
Mm-hmm.
Very few people know that Matthew Brady actually began his career as a casemaker for daguerreotypes about 1841 in New York City.
Wow.
He quickly realized that making cases was going to get him X numbers of dollars, but taking daguerreotypes would get him a lot more dollars and a lot more fame and, you know, prominence in the world. And he was a showman. But the thing is, he probably started making dags around 1843, and he was very good from the beginning. By 1850, the chemistry, and we should mention that to process these daguerreotypes, you had to use vapors of mercury. Now, you got to be real careful about that. And at first, a lot of guys didn't realize, you know, that you had to have really good ventilation.
Yeah,
well,
so
Grady...
Crazy, right?
Pardon me? Yeah, you could. Mad as a hatter. You know, right. That's when they do the napping process, they use vapors of mercury, too.
Mm-hmm.
By about 1850, Brady couldn't see well enough because of his exposure to the chemistry to actually focus his camera. So he had others, you know, doing his work.
Is that true?
Wow. And during the Civil War, he would take his cameras out and he would have other people focus them for him, and he would just sort of take the lens off and very pompously, you know, tell everybody everything's in control and put the lens back on. He, by that time, he wasn't shooting daguerreotypes, though. He was making wet plate negatives on glass and then making multiple prints on albuminized paper. But that's for another day.
Yeah.
back to the daguerreotype. When we were talking about the pricing earlier on, and you were talking about the outdoor scenes, and the post-mortems, and sometimes a soldier from the Mexican War. Well, those were no-brainers, because people could see them, and they knew they were different. And if you had a large plate, a whole plate, or a half plate, sometimes even a quarter plate, people would put a premium on that. Then if they saw the name Matthew Brady, or Southworth and Hawes, who were Boston's greatest daguerreotypist, and possibly the greatest daguerrean firm in the world, people would know to add money to it. So here I come into this in 1985, and I see this huge gap between $25 and $1,000, and I'm saying to myself, I can make money doing this. And at the time, I was a professional photographer, and I traveled all over the country doing architectural, aerial, industrial-type work. And I started collecting, and for 2 years, in the first 2 years, I bought 2,000 DAGs.
Wow.
They were readily available.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started to trade and started to sell them. And my forte was taking portraits, which were so common, but identifying them as art. And for the very first day, I said to myself, you know, I have such a wide variety I can choose from. Why would I want to take one that doesn't have really good condition?
Uh-huh.
Now, with the caveat that after 150 years... you and I aren't going to look so good, no matter how well we stay in shape. And most daguerreotypes don't either.
Mm-hmm.
But much of the problem, Marty, lies with the filthy glass. So I learned from an expert restorer of daguerreotypes how to take the glass off and how to, you know, properly handle the daguerreotype and how to properly put on new glass and a new archival seal. He was a minimalist. I'm a minimalist. And one of the reasons why the daguerreotypes look so good on my site compared to others is because my son, who has taken up the restoration business, does all of that work. And we both feel that it's really important to see the dag as well as you can. And that means that you have to have nice, clear glass to look through.
Now, if the glass is sealed, how does it get so filthy?
About 80% of all daguerreotypes have been tampered with by someone before they come to our hands. So that's one way.
Mm-hmm.
Over 150 years, because of heat and humidity and dirt and dust getting through the seals, which were very porous, and a lot of them broke just naturally, you know, because the paper got so brittle that they didn't stay intact. So you could get things inside. We've actually seen bugs crawling back and forth on the surface of the plates. because remember, you have a leather case, and the bugs like to eat the leather and the glue. So, you know, they just crawl right through.
Wow.
But the chemistry of the plate itself causes vapors and outgassing, you know, to hit the glass. And then the glass being very porous and made of, you know, different kinds of chemicals would actually leach down onto the surface of the silver plate. And usually, aside from human hands, which have destroyed more dags than you can imagine, bad glass is what causes the most problems.
I see. Wow.
What I'd really like to say is to all your listeners, if you have daguerreotypes of your family, please don't take them apart. Because I will guarantee you, no matter how careful you are, you'll do something bad to them.
Uh-huh.
I'm not trying to drum up business for my kid, but folks, let me tell you, he's very, very good. And his prices are very reasonable. So that's that plug, right?
It's okay, we can do that plug.
Yeah.
Now, when you reseal them, what do you use, a modern-day sealer?
We use a tape made in Germany called Filmoplast.
Mm-hmm.
It's self-adhering. It's a white tape, and it comes in rolls. And, you know, you pull it apart, and then after you use, we use regular window glass. Other people try to use different types of glass, but I'm not convinced just yet that they're doing the right thing. So as I say, we're very minimalist. Mm-hmm. The daguerreotypists use glass, the mat, the tape. We use glass, mat, and tape. You know, we don't do anything esoteric. And one thing about the silver, it tarnishes, just like your silverware would tarnish in a silver drawer.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
To clean the surface of a daguerreotype, to remove the tarnish, is taking a huge risk.
I would think so.
Many daguerreotypes were hand-colored.
Right.
Very beautifully. And in fact, that's the second part of my collection, is hand-colored images of children especially.
Wow. Yeah.
If you try to clean off the silver, the first thing that comes off is the tinting.
Mm-hmm.
I have to laugh when people, especially dealers and collectors who should know better, you know, show me something and tell me how beautifully it's tinted, and I look at it and think to myself, yeah, it was tinted a lot nicer before somebody cleaned it.
Oh. So a lot of these things are cleaned. That's amazing.
Of the 80% of the images that have been tampered with before we get a hold of them, 80% of those have been cleaned. The surface has actually been cleaned. Now, you'll love it, because back before about 1950, when the thiarea method was invented to clean the silver, they actually used cyanide vapors.
Oh, that's healthy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Mercury vapors, cyanide vapors.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's not something that people want to delve into quickly, you know, without thinking about it. In fact, going back to my son for a minute, who's in the business with me, he now makes daguerreotypes himself. And in fact, there's a stack of them right next to your elbow over there.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about modern day daguerreotypes, and I wanted to take a little side jag on that. But I want to skip back right now. We were talking about cases earlier. You talk about the tooled leather case is the common one. Now, did gutta percha, was that in the daguerreotype era, or was that later in the ambrotype?
Neither. Because gutta percha, I'm just going to educate you here, Marty. You know, I want you to be correct.
I told you I learned something.
Yeah, yeah. Gutta percha is a resin that's found in a natural state. And it was used for many things, but never photo cases. What people invented in about 1852 or 53 were injection molded plastic cases. They look like gutta percha, but they're not. And in fact, photo cases were the very first use of injection molded plastics in the world to hold daguerreotypes.
I had no idea plastic was at all.
Yeah, no. You know, I tell people that and they go, are you kidding? I said, no, here, look. Yeah, that's how old plastic is. But not the kind of plastics you have today, of course, because what they would do, they would use resins and glue and wood shavings and you know, heat something at a high temperature and put in some other stuff, and they'd have this concoction that they would pour into these huge steel molds that had been delicately carved, because some of the designs on the plastic cases and even the leather cases are just, you know, unbelievably well done.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, many times back in the from 1900 forward, people would buy the plastic cases and throw away the images and use them for their own pictures or whatever.
Yeah, I know. I've seen some really fancy cases. I've seen mother of pearl inlay cases. And
that's a different type. Yeah,
yeah.
That's wood and paper with inlaid mother of pearl on Japan black.
Right.
Surface. You have ivory used on some cases. Tortoiseshell.
Now, are there people that collect just cases?
Oh yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There really are. I mean, it's you know, up until eBay came along about 10 years ago. I had four or five people that I sold cases, plastic cases, to on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. But all of those people have most of the great ones, and they appear so, they're so much easier to find now because of, well, because of computers in general, mm-hmm. that, you know, I can very rarely buy a case that they don't already have. Mm-hmm. So I'd say that case collecting itself has, what do I want to say, has been diminished.
Okay.
By you know, your ability to buy in computers.
Now we're talking about computers, eBay. What has changed in what you do since eBay came along?
Well, I'll be kind and say that my daughter, Erin, who is also in the business with us.
Nice.
She, with all the formal education, decided that it was easier to work with us than to get a real job. I'm sorry, Erin. I'm just telling the truth here. She uses eBay very effectively to sell.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like to buy or sell at auction unless it's something, you know, just so rare that I don't even have a client for it myself.
Mm-hmm.
I've used Sotheby's a few times to sell some very important pieces, sometimes with great success and other times with not so, such great success.
Mm-hmm.
As far as buying at auction, Marty, whether it's a live auction in front of me where I can see the material or, you know, on eBay or anywhere else, I personally don't buy that way.
Hmm.
It's just a thing, because I'm a condition freak, I like to be looking at it, holding it, and know the price ahead of time.
You did know this was the Antique Auction Podcast.
I do that, yeah.
Okay.
But I'm just, you know, I'm here to tell you the honest truth because you're asking.
No, I know. So do you have connections, like just people that know? Well, you talked earlier, you talked about buying at shows. What are some of the ways that you buy besides shows?
I buy DAGs back from a lot of my clients.
Uh-huh.
I always try to give them the same price or a little bit more if I can.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes my own financial situation doesn't permit that.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they need money quickly and they need me to buy more rather than less. We still can buy in shops. As I said, we buy very well at Brimfield. Mm-hmm. Brimfield, by the way, is... Brimfield, Mass. Is where there's flea markets held three times a year in May, July, and September. And in fact, Marty and I think we're both going our separate ways
yes.
tomorrow.
I'm actually going to be recording a little bit.
Oh, are you really? Nice. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Nice. I mean, Brimfield, to my estimation, is still the last best place to buy anything.
Mm-hmm.
If you like a circus-like atmosphere,
mm-hmm.
you have to be really quick on your feet, and you have to just be persistent because... It's about 2 miles along Route 20, where dealers set up on both sides of the street, and it could be, you know, thousands of dealers, and there's dust and dirt and heat and sweat and...
Don't forget the mosquitoes.
Mosquitoes.
Yeah.
and crabby people and bad food, and I love it. I mean, you know, you get to see a lot of people, and you really do suffer, though. I mean, tomorrow it's supposed to be in the mid-80s with the dew point around 70 and the humidity around 80%. Now, for us New Englanders, man, I mean, that's hot.
That means you're almost breathing pure water. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, that's really cool to know.
All right.
But back to eBay again. It's changed the whole dynamics because now anybody can be a dealer.
Mm-hmm.
And images that would have appeared at shows and in antique shops do not.
Right.
It has helped my business immeasurably because it's given a higher awareness of what daguerreotypes are.
Ah.
I don't sell probably to maybe one or two people a year who would buy regularly on eBay, but it's given it a much broader scope. So many more people know about daguerreotypes.
Can we just take a pause right here? Can you tell me, for our listener that does not know too much about a daguerreotype, how to tell a daguerreotype from, say, a tin type or ambrotype? Maybe we should talk a little bit about the different types of photos that they may run across.
Sure. Daguerreotypes were first. They're the earliest form of photography, and in my estimation, still the best medium for making a photograph. If it's done right. The silver is pretty much grainless. So once you get into paper photography, there's always a grain involved. The mirror light surface gives it a three-dimensional depth that really no other photograph has, unless you do a holograph, which really isn't a photograph. The Ambrotype came into being about 1854, and it was a poor man's daguerreotype. It's on a piece of glass, and it's actually a negative image, and you either have to have had it taken on a dark piece of glass, which would cause the image to go positive, or you would have to put some kind of a black backer, either a shellac or even a piece of cloth, to make it go positive. That was that started in about 1854. Then in 1856, two men in Ohio simultaneously got patents within a few months to make tintypes. Neither one knew the other one was working on the process. It was really crazy. The tintype is on base metal, and it's really a poor man's image. It, like the daguerreotype, the ambrotype, and the tintype, are all positive images. There's no negative. And they're all laterally reversed, Marty, because even though they would use a mirror to focus, the mirror was not left in the camera when the exposure was made. In other words, the light came through the lens, and it came through and hit the plate, the sensitized plate, backwards. So when you look at an ambrotype, a tintype, or a daguerreotype, you're looking at a laterally reversed image. Hence, in the great outdoor scene, say, of the Gold Rush, and you see buildings, well, the signs are backwards. Now, if the signs read correctly, one of two things occurred. It could be a copy of the original image, because to make a second daguerreotype, you either had to take a second one physically, or you could take the naked plate and you could copy it onto another daguerreotype plate, which would reverse it. Well, the other way, Marty, and this is kind of cool, they could use a reversing prism, and they would put that on the front of the lens. But what happened was, because it was two 45-degree angles, you would have to point the camera north to take a picture facing west or east, depending on which way the prism was. So your camera would actually be pointed 90 degrees away from what you were photographing. Hence, you don't see too many portraits that were reversed, just because it would be kind of disconcerting, don't you think? You'd be sitting there, and the camera's looking over the other way.
Spy camera.
So you were asking about dates. Daguerreotypes effectively were being made in America at the very end of 1839 up through 1865, the Civil War. By the end of the Civil War, they were still being taken, but mostly in the big cities or way out in the sticks somewhere. Ambrotypes came into the field about 1852 or 53, the images on glass. They were done by 1870. Tintypes came into play about 1856, and people were making them regularly up until 1940.
Really?
Yeah.
All the way to 1940?
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. But DAGs, for the most part, were done by about 1860. And it wasn't because of the ambrotype and the tintype so much, but because of people making images on a collodion glass negative. Once you made a glass negative, you could make any number of prints on albuminized paper.
So that's what you see a lot of the Civil War, like the...
Exactly. That's the that's
cabinet photos and things
well,
like
actually,
that.
Well, actually, yeah, carte de visite is what they were called.
Yeah, right. The one thing that I always that always fascinates me, I know there's modern-day daguerreotypes. You just show me some wonderful ones that your son takes.
Right.
And is there a market for that, those?
There are. Back in about 1890, there was a revival. For short, it was short-lived. 1890. Some people were doing them. Then a few people were doing them again around 1930, 1940, maybe into the 1950s. People at the George Eastman House in the late 60s and through the 1970s created another revival, which has gotten bigger since then. Casey, my son, uses the 4x5 view camera that I use for my own photography business, which I retired from 14 years ago now, to buy and sell DAGs. That's all I do now, is buy and sell daguerreotypes. So he shoots a 4x5 plate, And he doesn't have his plates clad with silver on copper. He has his plates electroplated with silver.
Smart.
Because trying to find a person to clad them was just impossible. We spent a year and a half finding a copper source, mm-hmm. and then how we could get it finished to the plate size. Then we spent another 6 months looking for a plater who happens to be nearby in Newburyport, Mass., who's worked with us. It took him 4 or 5 months to get it right, mm-hmm. and now that he does, he gives Casey plates that are just phenomenal.
Wow. Now, along those lines, let's talk about fakes.
Fakes with daguerreotypes are much harder to produce than in other types of photography, especially negative to paper. I was once handed at a photo show a small daguerreotype that measured 2 by 2.5 inches of the White House. Being that I love very early images and I know what they look like, I thought to myself that this guy was handing me a dag of the White House, an experimental dag made about 1840. Until he popped it out of the case and his name was signed on the back and he copied it from a photograph of the White House. And I should have known right away because the White House didn't look like the copy of that photograph. What a dummy I was. But my heart was in my throat because I really thought that this was a very rare thing.
I think in any line of this business, we've all tried to convince ourselves when we think we have something rare in our hands.
And that brings up a good point. When you have someone that looks like a famous person, and I get these questions all the time, how do you determine if it's who you think it is?
You mean like Custer or someone like that?
Well, in the daguerrean era, you could go, say, to Mark Twain, for example. Mm. Casey has a daguerreotype that he bought a few years ago that when he brought it home, I looked at it and I said, son, that's Mark Twain. And he looked at me and he started laughing. He says, no, it's not Mark Twain. I went to bed. The next morning, I see this note where I usually sit for breakfast. Dad, you're right. It's Mark Twain. And, you know, he had all these links for me to go to. I didn't even need to. I just knew it was him. But trying to prove that to people has been a 2.5-year project. Mm-hmm. And we're still, you know, we're really working hard to prove it. Because this daguerreotype was taken in 1863 in a San Francisco studio that Casey identified because of the carpet. So we know exactly where it was taken. Mm-hmm. We know Twain was in San Francisco, and I believe it was May and June of 1863, the very first time he went to San Francisco. He had just dropped the Samuel Clemens name, and now he was becoming known amongst the actors and actresses and the more famous, edgy types of people. Who, you know, he became their patron almost.
He was on his way out west and stayed in a town for a while before he went out?
Well, what happened was he and his brother deserted from the Confederate Army in the Civil War. Mm-hmm. And his brother, I think, went out to, I think it was Nevada. And if it's Utah, I apologize. But anyway, Twain went out west to join him. So Twain had been on the road and on the run for about 2 years. And when he got out there with his brother, he actually speculated in land. He went out in the fields and dug for gold and silver. Twain was a rough-edged character at that time. And he just naturally matriculated to these other people. And he started writing articles for the local newspapers. And when he went to San Francisco the very first time, he bought himself new clothes. He went out and was wined and dined by the most important people in San Francisco. He made them believe that he was important. And one of the things that Casey found in his research was a letter written about the time he was in San Francisco. He sent his mother a picture. Now, the daguerreotypes were called pictures from the very beginning, okay? Mm-hmm. He sent his mother a picture, and she wrote back and said to him, "It makes you look old. You look at this image of Twain, who would be 28 or 29 years old. He looks very old." Hmm. But then, you think about it. What had he been doing the previous 2 years? And
hard life.
Hard life. Now, when he had pictures taken in paper, 3 or 4 years later, his skin is smoother and his face is softer. Mm-hmm. Those have all been retouched. They could do that then. Really? You know, he was very vain. He actually says that I didn't like one of the pictures that was taken of me. So what he did, he cut out his head. He drew his caricature and pasted it to the back of the photograph and sent it to some friends. He said, this is what I really look like.
A little vanity there.
A lot of vanity.
Yeah.
So that image will be the most important daguerreotype that Casey and I have ever had.
Sure.
If we can conclusively, you know, prove that that's who it is. And I don't need to be, it doesn't need to be proven to me.
Can I see it?
I'll show it to you in a few minutes.
Sorry, everyone. Yeah. Now, since we're on this, I wanted to ask you a couple things. The rarest piece you've had, you kind of just went into that. I'm sure there's been many more, but I want to talk about the image on your homepage right now. It's a great image. And can you just talk about that?
Sure. It's a quarter plate daguerreotype that I bought out of a collection that a man had assembled over 50 years. And I got it about 3 years ago, I think. It shows five men in front of a log fort. And I spent 2 years studying forts in America, circa 1848 to about 1854. Mm-hmm. Because when people were on the move from east to west, if daguerreotypists were shooting in the west right after the gold rush, you know, began in 1849, they would take, if they went overland and they were lucky, it would take them 9 months to get from east to west.
Right.
If they went around the horn, it would take them a little bit longer depending on how the weather was and things. Mm-hmm. So if a daguerreotypist was traveling from east to west, and this was a fort somewhere along, you know, one of the trails, he would have things that he had brought with him. And the further he went, the older the materials, the plates and the cases would be. Mm-hmm. And that's a couple of the ways to actually date daguerreotypes is what's the matte style around it and what is the case style. Mm-hmm. Both the matte and the case around this probably date from about 1850. This image could be taken anywhere from 50 to 52 or 53 or 54. My research showed that there were only two or three forts in the entire United States that had this kind of huge hand-hewn wooden beams at that time.
Yeah, they're squared-off logs.
Yeah, and they're cottonwood.
Ah.
And cottonwood...
From Colorado?
Colorado area. Mm-hmm. But more importantly, this image, I think, was taken at Robideau's second trading post along the Oregon Trail in Carter Canyon, Nebraska. Hmm. Again, you look at the cut of these guys... The man on the right definitely is not a Caucasian man. He looks to be, you know, like a French-Canadian type, and that's what the Robideaus were. So that's how I started, you know, thinking about who these people might be. Mm-hmm. The other four men are definitely Caucasian, but they are rough men.
They sure are.
The thing is, why were they so well-dressed if they were on the road? Mm-hmm. And who made the image? Well, an itinerant had to have made it because he was on the road with them.
Right, yeah.
The thing is, whoever this itinerant was, he was a technical genius. And he had very good equipment.
Itinerant means someone that travels all the time.
Yeah.
And an itinerant painter, someone that bounced around town.
Correct. He could have had a studio somewhere, mm-hmm. but then he traveled in the rural towns too.
Yeah.
You know, this guy who made this image was traveling out to the gold fields. There's no question about it.
Sure.
And some of the very best daguerreotypists ended up in San Francisco and Sacramento and Marysville in the first 1 to 2 years.
If you had to say right now how many daguerreotypes you have, would you be able to guess?
Sure. I have about 2,000 in inventory, down from 6,000 in 2001, and I have about 600 in my permanent collection, which is permanent until somebody comes in and offers me a lot of money for something. Hey, folks, I'm in the business. I'm sorry, you know?
Yeah. I can see just from talking to you that the research is a passion of yours.
Oh, it is. But the problem is, when you make a living, you know, doing this, you have to be quick on your feet. You have to not only find new images, but you have to continually market them so that, you know, you can stay ahead of the curve. I mean, and the ones that I really spend a lot of time trying to research are the ones that are dearest to me. I mean, the very early images, which we talked about, you know, that were made 1839 through 1842 into 43, those images I have spent more time collectively researching than all the other images I've ever handled, because that's what fascinates me the most.
I see. Now, you're talking about collecting. Now, I know there are people that collect just things like postmortem, things like that. So do you deal with people that... Do you, like, right now, if you got a certain image in, you know exactly who to contact because they collect a certain segment?
In the past, before, you know, eBay and the computer-generated sites and things, my own included, I had many more people who collected thematically who I could call if I had something. What I've always recommended to my better clients is that, yes, collecting your theme, but also expand it, because not only will it make your collection better as a whole, but it will give you a better understanding about daguerreotypes in general.
Now, I always thought postmortem was kind of a strange thing, and I hope I don't offend anyone by saying that. But that is an image, say, of a child or a husband or a loved one who passed away, and the daguerreotypist would come in. Is it daguerreotypist? Is that
a... Daguerreotypist.
Daguerreotypist would come in and take an image, a last image of that loved one.
They can be very macabre. I once bought a daguerreotype at Brimfield, the flea market, and it was a sixth plate daguerreotype, a standard size, and it showed four men holding a coffin where the corpse had been exhumed.
Oh.
So, literally, they had the top off, and the guy was only half there. You could see some flesh, some clothes, some bones.
They really wanted to remember him.
They wanted to remember him for some reason. But what was really strange, not only were you looking at this man after he'd been dug up, but two of the guys, you could see from the waist to their heads, but the two at the top of the picture, they cut them right at the neck, so you couldn't even see them. So, I'm just standing there, and this guy's showing it to me. And this is an example how fast moving a daguerreotype can be. The guy bought it for nothing. He sold it to me for, I think it was $300 or $400. I sold it to a guy 10 minutes later for $1,000, and I was dancing in the street. I thought, oh my God, I just did da 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 da. So like 5 hours later, a guy comes up to me who I barely knew, and he said, "Look what I bought here in this field." And I'm looking, and I go, "Wow, that's really nice. How much did you pay?" He said, $3,500, and I think it's a bargain. And I wasn't dancing in the street anymore. I'm thinking, son of a gun. But, you know, that was a good lesson learned, because there's two ways to sell things. Turn it quickly, take your profit, and go on.
Sure.
Or keep it and do the research and maybe make more money, but maybe not. So, you know, when you're out and about, You always have to be thinking around the next curve. You have to think, you know, what do I know about this right now? What's the potential of it? What's the real condition of it? You know, what's it going to look like when Casey takes off the glass? Is it going to be better or worse? All those things, you know, come into play. One fast rule that I've given myself, and I tell people on my website how I buy DAGs. The way I buy a DAG is, the condition's got to be really good. I have to like it enough to own it. And I have to be able to afford it.
Yeah.
Those are my three golden rules.
Yeah.
I never once have bought a DAG for someone else.
Oh, I see.
I buy it for myself. Because you know what? A lot of times, the people that I used to think would like things that I would send them to, they didn't like it as much as I did.
Right.
Or they didn't have the money or whatever. So that means I keep it. So, you know, look behind you. I mean, there's a whole, you know, huge case of DAGs, and then we'll go around the corner and there's other cases of DAGs. I like those DAGs. I don't want to have something that I look through every day that I don't like.
That's really a good way for a collector to buy.
Or anything.
Anything.
But here's the other thing. eBay and other sites have made it so easy for collectors to buy. In my humble opinion, so many collectors are making mistakes because they're not learning anything. They're just buying things. Mm-hmm. They're accumulating.
Yeah, but the gatherers.
They're gatherers. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. If you take every image and think about what you bought, what you paid for it, and what you have, but most people don't. Knowledge today will definitely win out over, you know, people just accumulating. They might get lucky, mm-hmm. but a person with real knowledge, a person who wants to study what they collect, and I'm not just talking about DAGs, Marty, I'm talking about anything that you collect. Mm-hmm. Go to somebody who knows. Mm-hmm. Talk to them. Ask them questions. And if they can't answer it and are unwilling to get, you know, back to you, then go to somebody else.
Now, I remember years ago looking at your website, and you had a beautiful image on there. I think you titled it Pensive Woman or something like mm-hmm. that. It was a real sad-looking girl. If you're collecting or you're buying, like you're saying, what are the parameters in the image itself that make you attracted to it? Is it something like that, something unusual, a beautiful woman, say? Or
when I open up a leather or plastic case, if there's something that grabs me about the subject, mm-hmm. be it sad, exciting, beautiful, handsome, ugly, primitive, mm-hmm. I give a lot of qualifiers, but if viscerally I go, wow, that's it.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
But then, to add on to that, then I study it. I mean, I drive dealers crazy. You know, I'll be out and about, and it takes me sometimes 10 or 15 or 20 minutes to really look at it. Because when you're looking through a layer of filthy glass, mm-hmm. I want to make sure that I'm buying quality. Now, as the eyes get a little bit older, mm-hmm. you know, and the hands get a little shaky and the loop moves back and forth, you know, it isn't as easy as it used to be.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if I'm looking at an image where the glass is clear and this thing is just screaming at me, you need to own this, then I just get really mellow and, you know, look at it. And if the person asks me, well, isn't that a great image? If it is, I'll say, you're darn right, it's a great image. Mm-hmm. And if there's no price on it, of course, I'm always wary because my price could be not the same as your price.
Yeah.
And that
yeah.
really ticks me off. Yeah. But anyways, you know, I'm a big boy. I know how to walk away if the price is too much.
Yeah.
You know, hence my reason for liking to buy in hand, because I'll pay whatever it takes to get a great image if I think the person really knows why it's a great image.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, here's another thing. My father, when I was young, growing up in this business, he told me, oh, you always pop a daguerreotype out of the case because sometimes you find a gold coin. Have you ever heard of that?
I certainly have, and believe me, I've taken probably 20,000 or 30,000 DAGs out of cases, and the best thing I've probably ever found, other than identifications, which is yeah. about 10% of the time, is a moldy piece of hair. There ain't no gold coins yeah. left.
Yeah, I'd like to find them identified. That's,
yeah.
that's really nice.
Well, daguerreotypes are identified about 10, maybe 15% of the time, either by the maker, the daguerreotypist himself, or by who the person was.
Now, I saw at John McGinnis's auction a number of years ago, an identified woman that sold for a ton of money. Did you see that? Like $13,000?
You know, I vaguely remember hearing about it, but as I say, I don't go to auctions,
yes,
so
right.
I really don't follow them. I
yeah.
mean, it's all I can do 7 days a week to keep up with my own business. It's just dynamic.
And we're just getting ready to wrap it up here, but I wanted to ask you, it seems like, just in talking to you, it seems like the daguerreotype business is alive and well, and not all segments of the business are, and I'm wondering about how the economy is affected.
You know, it's a hard thing, because from about 1998 till about 2007, every person that was selling daguerreotypes was active mm-hmm. and happy.
Mm-hmm.
When 2008 came around, and you know, the gloom and doom started.
Mm-hmm.
I told my kids, I said, you know, we're going to have a long haul here to get out of this, because they're not telling us as much as I think they know, and I think that the downturn is going to be steeper than they really say, and I think it's going to be longer.
Mm-hmm.
So
good call.
No, I told them that in 2008. So we sat down and they said, well, what can we do? And I said, well, there's a couple things we can do. We can go out and we can really start to look at people who we've sold images to see if they want to sell them back. Because, Marty, to tell you the truth, if I've handled an image and I loved it enough to own it once, I sure as heck love it enough to own it a second time. Mm-hmm. So...
Well, along those lines, how many what's the record of how many times you owned an image? Do you remember?
Four
times?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And the fourth time I bought it back, I remember this so readily. The fourth time I bought it back for a third of what I sold it for the first time. Now, people will say, well, how the heck does that happen? Okay, so I sell you an image for $100. Mm-hmm. You trade the image to somebody, and they think it's worth $75. They sell it to somebody who, you know, pays whatever they want. Then they make a trade in a big deal, and the last person who gets it just thought it was a throw-in. Mm-hmm. So they show it to me. I want $25 for this. Okay, fine. You know, or $30 or yeah. Whatever. It happens.
Now, along those lines, do you remember every image you had? Like, if you see it again?
Sadly, I don't anymore. In the first 10...
Well, 25,000 that you can remember probably. Well, yeah. It's a little difficult.
In the first 10 years, I could remember every image mm-hmm. that I bought, what I paid for it, where I bought it. I mean, it was just like, oh my gosh, do I need to keep all this information? But it was fun then, you know, to do that. You know, before we do end, I just want to thank you for the opportunity. I love to talk about DAGs and, you know, photography in general. I mean, it's been my life since I was 21 years old, so it's nice to have you here.
Thank you. It's been great. And so, I'm sorry I interrupted you when we were talking about the economy and the effects of it.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so the economy. So, I told the kids, you know, that we should go out and we should, you know, try and find which clients, you know, want to sell back things that we sold them or sell us things from their collection that we didn't know about. That alone has permitted us to continue to buy very, very intelligently. We have never had many clients, and the ones that we have are willing to pay us a premium for the images that we find because, one, they know the condition is going to be really good to begin with, mm-hmm. and two, they know that, you know, our selection process is very stringent, so to speak. Mm-hmm. I will say my son Casey, you know, he does buy off eBay on occasion, and I look at what he bought, and I just kind of go, you sending that one back, son? And he goes, nah, I'll get rid of it. And, you know, I tell you, I've seen things come in this door that he bought somewhere, either on electronically or at an auction, in the field, and I wouldn't have given him 2 cents for it. And the next thing I know, he's counting out $100 bills or a check, and I'm going, how did you do that? How did you do that? And the way he does it, and he knows this better than me, very few people are as condition conscious as I am. So he deals sometimes with people who will take a great image that has less than perfect condition mm-hmm. and pay him a lot of money for it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I've thought about doing that myself, but mm-hmm. you know, I've sort of taken this path and I'm comfortable here.
Yeah.
In a downturn, it's really difficult, you know, to keep the highest level. But, you know, we manage. Mm-hmm. We're always looking for new clients, you know, who are very sophisticated. As I said earlier, my daughter Erin sells very successfully on eBay. She has a large following. She sells DAGs, Ambrose tins, and all kinds of paper photographs. Casey also deals in non-daguerreotypes. Mm-hmm. Not nearly as aggressively because he's got so many other things on his plate. The restoration, you know, being the primary thing because he restores probably 50% of the images he restores, Marty, are from people who have family images.
Nice.
Yeah, he takes great pride in that, you know.
Yeah. Well, I think we're going to wrap this up, but let me just say, let's throw out your website name, please.
It's findags.com.
Findags.com. So if anyone listening to this has a daguerreotype you're interested in having evaluated or possibly sell, that's interesting, feel free to contact Dennis. And if you need one restored, his son Casey, you can find all on this website. You can find the whole family on the website, right?
We kind of keep Erin quiet. You know, she's our stealthy
buyer and seller. Got it. Okay, this is Martin Willis with Dennis Waters and the Antique Auction Podcast, and we're signing off.
Today's show was brought to you by Audible. Visit audiblepodcast.com/auctionpodcast for your free audiobook download. There are over 75,000 titles to choose from. We thank you for listening today, and we hope you enjoyed the show.